This is VOA One of the Hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower. And our stories are written especially for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the health and lifestyle report. Today, Dr. Jill Robbins will tell us about a type of tree and how it helps us. Brian Lynn will tell us about a COVID variant found in India. I will return with a story on a riding school in London. Dan Friedel brings us a story about families who were separated at the U.S.-Mexico border. We will finish our 30 minutes together with our series on national parks in the United States. But first, here is the Health and Lifestyle Report.
The longleaf pine tree has deep connections with the history and life of the eastern part of America. Forests of these trees once covered two-thirds of the southeastern United States. About 95% of those forests were lost in the past 100 years. Many of the forests were cut for their wood, but now they are returning, with the help of government programs that build ties with private landowners. The wood of the tree is very strong. Most buildings built in the southern U.S. from the 1800s contain longleaf pine wood. Today, after a building made with longleaf pine is no longer wanted, people are reusing the wood because it is still good and resists water and insect damage. The longleaf pine also captures carbon dioxide in the air. It stores the substance in its wood. So the tree is valuable to the environment as a way to store carbon. In addition, the pine forests are places for animals to live. The U.S. government has several programs to protect and expand longleaf pine forests. One is the Safe Harbor Program. It uses voluntary agreements with private landowners to help endangered animals. One such agreement protects the red-cockaded woodpecker and also lets landowners use their land, as long as the birds and other related animals can safely live on it. Now, farmers and landowners in the southeastern U.S. are growing new longleaf pine trees. Instead of cutting the trees to use as building materials, they are finding ways to make money from the forest of living trees. One way to get income is by selling the leaves or needles of the trees as a ground cover. Farmers can gather the pine straw by hand or with use of a machine. Pine straw can be used instead of wood pieces or bark as a ground cover. It lasts a long time, is lightweight, and stays in place because the needles connect to each other. The straw is high in nitrogen, a nutrient that helps plants grow, and it does not attract harmful insects. Native American tribes, such as the Choctaw and Cherokee nations in Louisiana, make coiled baskets from the long needles of the longleaf pine. A basket made of the pine needles by Native American artists can sell for as much as $750. Another way forests can produce income is to sell hunting rights. Wild boars, a kind of pig, live in some forests. Their population has been growing out of control in recent years. The animals can damage the young longleaf pine trees, so landowners want to reduce their numbers. Hunting boar is a popular sport in the southern U.S., and the right to hunt on land can cost from $200 to $1,000 a day. The Kisatchi National Forest in west central Louisiana contains most of the remaining longleaf pines in that state. In the past, Native Americans burned the forest every 2 to 4 years, if lightning did not cause fires naturally. Fire helps the young pine trees to grow by clearing away the other plants on the floor of the forest. Recent debate has centered on the value of letting some parts of the forests burn for this purpose. I'm Jill Robbins.
Thanks, Dr. Jill. Now, let's hear a story from Brian Lynn.
India has recorded the world's sharpest increase in coronavirus infections in recent weeks. The crisis has put great pressure on the country's health system, causing hospitals in major cities to run out of beds, oxygen, and medicines. Scientists are studying whether a variant of the coronavirus is to blame for the unexpected rise in Indian cases. The variant, named B1617, has been reported in at least 17 other nations as well. Here is what health officials know about this variant so far. Shahid Jamil is a virologist in India. He said the variant contains a mutation in the spike protein, the part of the virus that attaches to human cells. The spike protein is targeted by existing vaccines. The mutation may mean that the vaccines offer less protection against the variant. The World Health Organization, WHO, said the B1617 variant was first identified in India last December. An earlier version was seen in October 2020. The WHO has called the virus version a variant of interest. That means it may have mutations that make the virus easier to spread, cause more severe disease, or escape vaccine immunity. The WHO has called other versions found in the United Kingdom, Brazil, and South Africa variants of concern, suggesting a higher threat level. The WHO says more study is urgently needed to find out whether the variants are driving the increases. Limited research carried out in laboratories has suggested the variant could be more transmissible. However, health officials say another highly transmissible variant that was first discovered in the UK is behind an increase in cases in some parts of India. Sujit Kumar Singh is head of India's National Center for Disease Control. He said that in New Delhi, UK variant cases almost doubled during the second half of March. But he said the Indian variant has been widely seen in Maharashtra, the country's hardest-hit state. Chris Murray is a disease expert from the University of Washington in the United States. He said the large amount of cases seen in a short period of time in India means there could be what he called an escape variant. Such a variant could be overpowering any past immunity from natural infections in some populations, Murray said. That makes it most likely that it's B1617, he added. But Murray also pointed out that more research is needed and that the spread is also being driven by the UK and South African variants. Carlo Federico Perno is with Rome's Bambino Gesù Hospital. He said it is very unlikely that the Indian variant is the only cause of India's sharp increase in cases. He pointed to large social gatherings as another possible cause. I'm Brian Lynn.
Thanks, Brian. Now, here is my story on a horse riding school in London. Usually, in school or in clubs, children are told not to horse around. Horsing around means to act badly. But in South London, there is a club that loves it when students horse around. The Ebony Horse Club is a riding school for children from poor families. General Manager Naomi Howgate runs the team that operates the school. With the help of volunteers, they give about 140 rides each week to children. They teach not only horseback riding, but also important life skills. The club recently reopened its stables. They were closed for months because of the coronavirus pandemic. The program's 8 horses have returned to their home after a long rest outside London in East Surrey. Across the road from Housing for the Poor, young people are again learning how to ride. They begin by learning how to get on the horse, or how to mount. Then they learn how to walk, trot, and finally canter the horses. These are specialized terms for how a horse walks or runs. One of the club's youngest riders is Shaddai McLeod. The 9-year-old was very excited to be back in the saddle. He rides after school, but he joins the team on Sundays to help in the yard. He said he gets great satisfaction taking care of the horses, cleaning out the stables, grooming the horses, and measuring out their evening meals. Shaddai recently received his first award for grooming. His sister Zion is 13 and works just as hard as her brother. As she saddles up her favorite horse, Eddie, for her lesson, she says how lucky she is to be a member of the club. "You would never think this was here in the middle of Brixton," she said. Brixton is in a London neighborhood once known for racial tension, crime, and violence. Along with riding close to home, Ebony Horse Club members take day trips to pony clubs in the English countryside. Before the pandemic, groups of children from the club had wonderful experiences. They also have traveled as far away as Sweden to ride horses. Several students who finished the program have found jobs in the horse industry. Ebony's senior youth worker is Radhika Nagar. She played an important part in keeping children and their families connected to the club during the pandemic. The club has experienced an increase in children wanting to join, but it needs donations to survive. The cost of riding is based on the rider's situation at home, Donors have continued to support the club during the COVID-19 pandemic. But, like other organizations, Ebony may experience money problems as the British economy recovers from the health crisis. However, Howgate told the Associated Press that the Horse Club plans to continue to raise money to not just maintain but grow their activities. I'm Anna Mateo. And now, here is a story from Dan Friedel.
The United States Department of Homeland Security said Monday it is working to reunite children who were separated from their families at the U.S.-Mexico border in recent years. Alejandro Mayorkas is the head of the Department of Homeland Security. He said his agency still has a lot of work to do. However, Mayorkas said, "We continue to work tirelessly to reunite many more children with their parents in the weeks and months ahead." The department announced that the families will be reconnected this week in what Mayorkas called the beginning of the effort. Two mothers, one from Honduras and one from Mexico, are expected to be reunited with their children this week. Some of the children were as young as 3 years old when they were separated. The department did not give details about the other families. In 2017, the administration of President Donald Trump put in place a policy that brought criminal charges against people crossing the border illegally. The policy meant that adults were separated from minors who were with them. Since then, some children have been permitted to remain in the U.S. while their parents were sent home. Some of them were sent to live with family members in the U.S. Others stayed in shelters run by the U.S. government. In July 2017, the number of children separated from their parents was over 5,000. That number has come down. The Trump administration ended its policy in 2018, but over the last 3 years, it has been difficult to connect parents with their children. The Biden administration has been under pressure from rights groups such as the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, to bring the families back together as soon as possible. The ACLU brought legal action against the Trump administration at the time to stop the separations. The reunifications expected this week are a result of the ACLU's legal action. In a legal compromise, the ACLU and the U.S. government worked to decide how many families needed to be reunited. Michelle Braunet is the director of the Biden administration's Family Reunification Task Force. She said the parents are permitted to come to the U.S. to join their children on temporary humanitarian grounds. However, the U.S. is still working to decide whether they will be permitted to stay for a longer period of time. Braunet said she thinks about 1,000 families are still separated. In an executive order signed during his first day in office, Biden said he would work to reunite families to the greatest extent possible. I'm Dan Friedel.
Thanks, Dan. And now, hosts Katie Weaver and Ashley Thompson take us to Biscayne National Park in the southern state of Florida.
On our national parks journey, we head to southern Florida. Here, you will find blue-green seas, marine wildlife, and islands that hold thousands of years of human history. Welcome to Biscayne National Park. Biscayne is not very far from the lights, noise, and excitement of downtown Miami. But it has a very different atmosphere from the big city. Biscayne National Park was established as a national monument in 1968. It became a national park in 1980. That year, its size also increased. The park now covers more than 70,000 hectares. It includes the northern part of the world-famous Florida Keys. Keys are low-lying islands or reefs.
If you enjoy water, Biscayne is the park for you. 95% of the park is water. Many kinds of animals live within the park. Some of them are threatened or endangered. You will find the huge, gentle West Indian manatee, the less gentle American crocodile, several kinds of sea turtles, and more than 500 species of fish. Four ecosystems come together here, which is what makes the park so diverse. The blending ecosystems create what is called edge communities. These edge communities support a huge array of wildlife. The underwater diversity is what attracts most people to Biscayne National Park. Many visitors come here to snorkel or scuba dive in Biscayne's clear and warm waters.
Human history at Biscayne begins more than 10,000 years ago. Scientists say evidence of the area's earliest people is mostly underwater now, as water levels have risen over time. Within the last 3,000 years, people began to settle in the area. Scientists continue to learn about these people by examining the big hills of shells they left behind. The shells contain other waste, too, including early tools and housewares. As the population grew, it divided into separate cultures. The groups began making pottery and created trade networks. These Native Americans are called the Tequesta. The Tequesta depended on the rich food source of the sea to survive. They were not centered on farming, which requires huge amounts of time. So the Tequesta had more time than other natives for art and religion. Very complex social structures developed as a result. European explorers began arriving in the area in the early 1500s. They brought with them diseases like smallpox and measles. Over time, these diseases killed huge numbers of Florida's natives. Early explorers arrived in the area on ships. The reefs and rough waters made it difficult for ship captains. Biscayne's waters contain more than 50 shipwrecks. Scuba divers today can explore 6 of them.
Among them is the Earl King, which sank in 1891. It was built in 1865. Earl King was mostly used to transport goods, but it also carried wealthy passengers. In its first few years of service, it was used for trading between China and Australia. The ship hit Long Reef as it sailed to New Orleans from England in 1891. Its machinery and other parts were saved, but Earl King itself sank to the sea floor. Another shipwreck that scuba divers can explore is the Lugano. The British steamship sank in 1913. At the time of its sinking, it was the largest ship ever to wreck in the Florida Keys. It was traveling to Havana, Cuba, carrying goods and more than 100 passengers. Most of them were Spaniards immigrating to Cuba. High winds and heavy seas sent the ship far off course. A collision with Long Reef damaged the ship. Much of the cargo and all of the passengers were safely removed. The captain and crew remained aboard. Many people tried to remove the water from Lugano and repair it, but after several weeks, they abandoned their efforts. Today, the Lugano remains on Long Reef, almost 8 meters below water.
Many visitors to Biscayne National Park choose to explore underwater. Guides lead snorkeling and scuba diving trips. These give visitors the chance to get up close to the park's underwater wildlife as well as its shipwrecks. Visitors can also explore the park on a boat. Canoeing and kayaking are great ways to enjoy Biscayne's mangrove forests. Mangroves are little trees that grow in coastal waters. Many people take a kayak or canoe around the islands and lagoons. At Elliott Key, visitors can set up camp and sleep in the wild. At Boca Chica Key, visitors can explore a lighthouse. The lighthouse has become a symbol of Biscayne National Park. It was built in the 1930s by Mark Honeywell, one of the island's former owners. The deck at the top of the 20-meter-tall lighthouse provides beautiful views of the ocean and the nearby islands. The top of the lighthouse also offers views of Miami Beach's famous skyline. But visitors to Biscayne National Park probably are not there to see skyscrapers and city lights. The beauty in Biscayne is quiet waters, rustling mangroves, and, if you're lucky, a visit with a manatee. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.